Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You might not be thinking about taxes right now. You'd rather be thinking about Black Friday and what kind of Christmas gifts and holiday gifts you're going to buy your family and friends. But you should be thinking about your taxes. As we near the end of 2011, you still have time to make some adjustments that could affect your filing in April. Joining us now to talk about that and take your questions is Jennifer Jenkins. She's a spokesperson for the IRS in Ohio. And she contacted me and said maybe we ought to do a show on it. Little did she know, we were already planning it. Welcome to the show, Jenny.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also with us is Bruce Gelsinger. He is the AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader, now in his eighth year of volunteering for the AARP Tax Aid Program. Welcome back to the show, Bruce. Are you still the leader?
Thank you. Yes, I am. Okay. Still the regional coordinator, yes.
All right. Question for listeners. It's nearing the end of the year, and that means it's time to start getting your ducks in a row for April 15th when your tax return is due, but not technically, actually, this year, because April 15th falls on a Sunday, I guess.
Correct.
So we'll be talking about that and more, but if you have questions or comments for our guests, Bruce Gelsinger, the AARP, or Jennifer Jenkins of the IRS in Ohio, we welcome your calls. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also post on the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Don't wait. Get those calls in. Get those questions in early. So let's talk about year-end preparation for filing taxes. It's November 21st. We've got about a month and a couple weeks, a month and a week or something like that. So 5 weeks to go. What should people be doing right about now, Jenny?
I would say the first thing is that if somebody hasn't already established some sort of filing system, now's a pretty good time to do it. And it doesn't have to be for most people. For most of your listeners, they probably don't have a lot of complicated tax information that they need to try to keep. But maybe something as simple as a shoebox, just to start trying to organize their files, any donations that they may have given over the year to charitable organizations, put those receipts somewhere that they can access them quickly when it comes time to actually crunch some numbers. Other receipts, if they've had home improvements and that sort of thing, some things may rate tax credits if it's a certain type of home improvement. Child care expenses, that sort of thing, just to try to start getting organized now to make sure that you're not going to be in a sort of sorry, sad state come, you know, January, February, when you actually start trying to put some numbers on paper.
To build on that comment a little bit, I think medical expenses are one that some people overlook. And even if you cannot itemize deductions on your federal return, if you have medical expenses exceeding 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, that is deductible in Ohio, the number that exceeds that 7.5%. Medical expenses can include insurance premiums, prescription drug out-of-pocket costs, doctor out-of-pocket costs, if you have eyeglasses, dental work, anything that's out-of-pocket expenses as well as the insurance premiums are medical expenses. And you can also deduct some mileage for getting to those medical appointments.
So there's a lot of people that have been out of work and or are working a couple jobs and they're not making a lot of money these days. This is definitely something they should be looking into.
Definitely something to look at, because some people will qualify to have itemized deduction on a federal, but as I mentioned, even in the state of Ohio, you can deduct those medical expenses over 7.5% of your adjusted gross income.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Hi, Berkey. You're in Columbus, and we welcome you to the show.
Thank you. I have a question. I changed my name about 2 months ago, so I was wondering what should I do before I file my taxes, since all my W-2s have previous name and I got new name.
So new name, the previous name will be on your W-2. What do you do, Jenny?
The main thing is you want to make sure that the Social Security Administration has the same name, basically, that as you file with the IRS, it's the same name that you have associated with your Social Security number. So I would say the first thing, and I'm sorry, I missed the first part of the adjusting my volume, but first thing is just to make sure that both of those agencies are in sync with each other.
How do you do that? Who do you call? I mean,
you can get hold of the Social Security Administration and update your name there,
okay,
because your Social Security, how your Social Security card is registered with that name, that's the name that must show on your tax return.
What if by chance he doesn't get to it before the wheels go into motion as far as the W-2 forms and that kind of a thing? what happens if you do have a different legal name than what appears on your W-2s? What should you do?
I would say he should still file and, you know, include the W-2s, obviously claim that income, because at some point it's going to come out in the wash.
Okay.
The Social Security number will be matched up against a name, and when the updated, you know, records take place, then it's important that he's actually claimed that income, not to not include that income, in other words.
Does that help, Berkey?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I appreciate it for that.
You bet. Take care.
You too.
614-292-8513. We're talking about end-of-the-year tips for getting those taxes in order, getting your tax return prepared maybe in advance, doing that kind of stuff you can do in advance before your W-2 arrives. My guests are Bruce Gelsinger. He's the AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader, and also Jennifer Jenkins of the IRS in Ohio. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, John.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I'm on disability. That's my only income. I was just wondering if I should file for a return or whether it's, you know, and a lot of my friends have that same question as to whether we should file or is it possible to get a return even and like that.
Okay. Disability.
Well, the tax law says that if you are under your normal retirement age and on disability, your disability income is treated as wages.
Okay.
And that may qualify for earned income credit depending on the amount of the wages. So, yes, I would definitely recommend reviewing that situation.
Yes. As a general rule of thumb, most types of Social Security disability income are not right. going to be taxed. But the best thing to do when in doubt, I'd say consult either, well, Publication 17 is a pretty good one, or go to irs.gov, www.irs.gov. And there is some very specific information on what Social Security income is taxable, because there may be some circumstances when, in fact, a certain portion of that may be if there's additional income that factors in to the household income, that sort of thing.
So, and my comment related to if the employer is paying you disability payments
okay.
and you're not yet retired, that could be treated as wages and earned income.
Okay. Oops, sorry, John. Hope that helped. 614-292-8513. And don't forget, you can email your questions to allsides@wosu.org. Rick, you're on the
yes.
air. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you. You're welcome.
My question is this. My daughter, first-time farmer for this year, she began her farm project, but with a very wet, long spring, we did not make required $2,500 for the first year in order to be tax exempt on purchases. She also had her tractor go down and she had to make another major purchase. The question is, where does that put her as far as her tax exempt status, and any advice for her to move forward?
That is one that I am just not familiar enough with the farm income. I can try to pull up some information
okay.
here on the computer if we have a little time to sort of tap dance here. But
Bruce, are you tap dancing too?
Yes, I am
okay.
because I'm a volunteer tax preparer and we have a limited scope and farms are outside of our scope, sorry to say.
Is there any publication that Rick could go to, anything that we can direct him to?
That's what I'm actually trying
okay.
to look up right
well, Rick,
now.
You keep listening, Rick, and when we find out what we can at least direct you to for more information that goes to what you're talking about, we'll announce it on the air.
I will, and if I could do a follow-up on the gentleman before me.
Okay.
On the he stated the disability Social Security income. Is that a situation that you can use your out-of-pocket expenses if you do have to file? Is that clear enough?
I'm not sure I understand yeah. the question. Social Security disability is generally not taxed.
Okay.
Employer disability payments is taxed.
Such as workers' compensation?
Workers' compensation is a taxable income, yes.
But
okay.
you have to meet a particular amount before that becomes taxable. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on what else is on your return, yes.
I understand.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very
okay.
much.
Hey, Rick, hang on.
I think I may have some information. IRS.gov, like I said earlier, is a pretty good resource. If anybody's online, you can just type in certain keywords and pretty much pull up just about anything. I believe that you might want to check out Publication 225. The IRS actually has a tax guide specifically for farmers, and that is Publication 225. And yeah, typically the income would be reported on, you know, a 1040 Schedule C, I believe, or C, EZ.
F.
Okay. So yeah, again, it's really getting outside of my, outside of my lane, but, I would recommend just check out Publication 225 if you have a chance.
Okay, Rick, hope that helps. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you want, if a question or a comment for our guests, Bruce Gelsinger from the AARP and Jenny Jenkins from IRS in Ohio. Marie in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Marie.
Thank you. Would the two representatives who represent two large organizations please ensure that those of us who are in our late 70s do not have computers and do have a hard time getting around, that we who have always, for at least 60 years, filed by paper, please ensure that we get the former booklets. Last year, I had to go to four different libraries, was not able to get what I needed, finally had to call my elected representative, and did finally get the papers that were needed. But somehow, please have the computer set up that if you filed on paper last year, that you will get a booklet in the mail automatically.
I have another suggestion for you.
Okay.
Look up one of the AARP tax aid sites or one of the other partnership sites with the IRS.
In the phone book?
No. Basically, you can call the local IRS office. You can call the AARP office to find out where a site is near you. If you don't have a computer, look it up online. We do free tax preparation. AARP specializes in low to middle income, special emphasis to seniors. We will electronically file your return for you, but you will get a paper copy of it. So that's another alternative if you're having difficulty getting the forms and doing it yourself.
We just simply need to get the booklet that we've gotten for 60 years.
So what's, yes, ma'am. What's the deal with that, Jenny?
Well, actually, there is another resource that is available. Seniors and people who may not be able to get out you can actually call, and the IRS will mail those documents to you. You'll specifically have to ask for certain forms, certain instruction booklets. But the number that you can call is it's a toll-free number, and I believe it's 1-800-TAX-FORM, 1-800-829, and then F-O-R-M. Typically, you'd want to call that toward the start of the filing season, January timeframe. Once the forms are actually printed and ready for dissemination. And within a number of days, depending on the availability of the specific forms and instructions, they will be mailed out to you. But again, you do need to know specifically which forms and instructions to ask for.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll post that number online, but Marie, you wouldn't appreciate that, would you? Thanks for the call, Marie. It was a good point. We're going to take a break right now. When we return, we'll continue our conversation about what you can do at this point in the game with your tax returns coming up for 2011. Bruce Gelsinger of the AARP and Jenny Jenkins of the IRS in Ohio are with us. If you have a question or comment for them, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Marie, that number again is 1-800-829-FORM. F-O-R-M, 1-800-829-FORM. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
OSU Police Chief Paul Denton, like at Penn State, his boss is part of the university's administration.
But in terms of police function, I am the chief of police and do have autonomy to run this agency and organization as any police chief would. as long as something brought to our
attention. Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News, 45 degrees with a chance of rain today and a high of 52. There's also a chance of rain tonight, a low of 46 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms are likely on Tuesday, a high of 64. Also, a good chance of rain for Tuesday night, maybe a thunderstorm as well, a low of 46 degrees. And then partly sunny looking ahead to Wednesday, a high of 50. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Maybe you're not thinking about taxes right now, but you should be. As we near the end of 2011, you still have time to make some adjustments that could affect your filing in April. That's why we're having this show today. My guests, Bruce Gelsinger, he's the AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader, and also Jenny Jenkins, she's spokesperson for the IRS in Ohio. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And once again, the number, to, if you want to call and order up your forms, because they're not dishing them out automatically this year or anymore, call 1-800-829-3676. That's 1-800-829-3676. From John in Marysville on email, he says, my wife and I are foster parents. Is foster care income able to be taxable? Are there tax deductions for foster care parents? Any ideas about that or any recommendations for where they can go for more information?
I guess that would be dealing with a dependent child, correct?
I think so. Yes, so there are tax deductions for dependent care. The individuals must be under 13 to qualify for dependent care coverage, and there is a 2441 form in the tax code that can be filled out for that.
I wonder why they cut it off at 13. Lots of older foster kids out there. But that's another question for another day. Filing deadline has changed. Now, this is something we'll go over in early April when we have the next show, but it is Tuesday, April 17th. It's not Monday, April 16th. I was surprised at that.
That's correct. There's a holiday in Washington, D.C. on that Monday.
Oh, okay.
So that pushes it to Tuesday. It's true for the federal and for the state. I would like to make a comment on that, though, because some people feel that when they file their taxes, that's when they have to pay if they're going to pay. And they can file taxes earlier and still just send in the payment
when it's due.
When it's due in mid-April, yes. So you don't have to wait till the last minute to file. You can still file earlier and then pay your taxes in mid-April.
So if you file and then pay later when they're due by April 17th in this case, mm-hmm. Do you just put something on the check that you're writing, Jenny? Or do you put your Social Security number or something like that? Or how do they?
Well, you should have a voucher.
Okay. Okay.
That you would show your Social Security number and your name and your address. So it's all on there. So it would be credited properly.
Okay.
And the important thing, I think, is to remember that you want to file on time if you're able to, or at least put in the automatic extension to, you know, file later. If you do owe any money, it's good to try to pay at least some of it as soon as possible, because there can be some late payment fees. So the main thing is don't not file. And avoid having a failure to file penalty. You don't want to tack any extra fees onto your return.
How many mistakes do people make now? I mean, does the IRS keep track of the error? How many errors there are? In other words, how many? You know, if you file early, you don't pay until it's due. But the IRS could, in the meantime, get back to you and say you don't owe as much as you thought you did. That's the best case
scenario.
There
are math corrections. I mean, I know I've received. On occasion where a correction has been in my favor. And I remember seeing a statistic going back a couple of years, I think to 2009 stats, that showed that the most common error was at that time the making work pay credit, people who failed to claim that. And then there was a correction done by the IRS noting that here's someone who probably was eligible for it and failed to claim, and therefore they maybe got a little bit more money back than they had anticipated, which is a good problem. But I think when people electronically file. They will be alerted to potential issues even before they can even submit their return in most cases, because a lot of the common errors that we see are fairly simple things like math miscalculations, failure to check a box, maybe failure to put the names and Social Security numbers in the proper order.
And they, by computerizing it,
there are so many advantages to electronically filing a return, and I appreciate the comment by one of the prior callers about paper returns, because that's the way it's always been done. But math errors are essentially eliminated with electronic filing returns. Yes, you have to know where the numbers go in the right boxes and all that. But if you do a refund, you also get the refund a lot quicker on electronically filing. It can be just a couple of weeks versus maybe 6 weeks on a paper filing.
Gail from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you. I'm 70 and a half years old, and I have to take IRA and 401 distributions. And I'm wondering if there's some way I can find out how to make charitable contributions to reduce that taxable income.
Well, one important thing with charitable contributions is you want to make sure that in order to deduct that, it has to be a tax-exempt organization recognized by the federal government, by the IRS. Most organizations that do hold that status will highlight that. They'll say we're a 501c3 and our contributions to us are, you know, tax deductible. So just make sure that if you are planning on giving to an organization, number one, that it is indeed recognized as being tax exempt by
like
the IRS.
Like WOSU.
Yes.
Just for example.
That could be a good example there.
Mm-hmm.
And also make sure that you keep a receipt, some sort of written documentation, because if you should be audited, which is a very low probability, but anyone listening who might be audited at some point, the folks at the IRS are going to ask for written documentation of a donation, even if it's a fairly small amount. So those small amounts can add up. So do keep a written record of your donation as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Gail.
Mm-hmm. 614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you have any questions for our guest, Jennifer Jenkins, spokesperson for the IRS in Ohio, and also Bruce Gelsinger, AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader. So the filing deadline's different. It's April 17th, 2012. It's a deadline. Tax scams. Is there anything at this time of year that people should be particularly worried about as we approach the end? Jenny?
Well, funny you should mention that. I just actually was alerted to the latest in a number of email phishing type scams, and this one had popped up in Western PA, you know, not too far from our area here. So as things go electronically with email, someone in your WSU listening audience could very well be seeing this particular email. It's asking for EIN, basically an employer identification number is wrong or something like that. Click on this and it'll, you know, take you to whatever. It's a bogus communication. The IRS does not communicate, at least initially, with taxpayers by email. It'd be very rare that there would be any email correspondence other than maybe from me to WSU or something like that. Normally, it will be written correspondence, official correspondence. So I think any time of the year is a game opportunity for scammers to try to, you know, prey on some unsuspecting individuals and on goodwill of people to try to, you know, get their hard-earned money. So just beware. Be a little cynical, skeptical if you see something, especially if it's by email. If there's a sort of a overnight sort of tax preparer shop that pops up on the corner and they say, hey, we can get you a good tax rebate. Just let us fill out this form for you and give us $50. You'll get $500 rebate back from the federal government. You know, it may sound pretty enticing.
If it sounds too good.
If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. So just, you know, be aware, sort of buyer beware kind of thing. This is your personal financial information. It's your Social Security number. Be cautious on who you give access to that information, especially when it's electronically via email.
Yeah. hearing any stories, Bruce, out there? Not yet?
Not too many.
I was kind of wondering if, given email, if there is and spam and just all the stuff, the phishing that they do, is there an increase in IRS-type scams?
I can't necessarily say there's an increase in scams. I know that our criminal investigative side is just about every day. I go online and I look to see what the latest IRS news is. And every day, somewhere in the U.S., there's someone who has been convicted of some sort of tax fraud scheme. And they can be very simple things to very complicated matter, you know, millions of dollars and embezzlement and that sort of thing. So I don't have any statistics to say it's on the increase or holding steady. I know that our enforcement folks are very diligent and doing everything they can to make sure that they get these folks that
are
it's a full-time committing
job.
The crimes. Yeah.
If you just joined us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests are Bruce Gelsinger of the AARP and Jenny Jenkins of the IRS in Ohio. We're talking about end-of-the-year tax tips. If you have any questions, we welcome them. 614-292-8513. You can also email us, as did Andrew, at allsides@wosu.org. And Andrew writes, based on what you're saying, as far as medical expenses go out of pocket, if you pay out of pocket for a home birth and none of it was covered under medical insurance, are those expenses taxable?
Well, first you have to meet, is it the 7.5% threshold? Mm-hmm. So 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. So if that adds into that amount and it's over that percent,
then it would be deductible from your income, yes, on Schedule A. Or if you're not using Schedule A for other things on the federal, it would still be a deductible expense in Ohio, to the best of my knowledge.
The insurance doesn't have anything to do for it as long as it was out of your pocket.
It's out-of-pocket expenses for medical expenses, yes.
I guess the question would be, how would you document that, though?
That would be a challenge.
Well, if you had expenses, then just get a receipt from the midwife or whoever.
Yes. Receipts are excellent. That's an excellent tracking system. And what should be assembled in, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, that's those types of things should be assembled so they are readily available for your tax preparer, whether you're doing it yourself or with someone else.
Tom, on the east side of Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I've clearly sustained a loss in my sole proprietor business and Schedule C. All other income is basically interest and dividends, and really, you know, by the time I post the loss and any other, it'll be basically negative income. So I really don't have anything that would be taxable. Should I file anyway the Schedule C? However, I did think about something I forgot about, and that's Schedule M and EIC.
You should certainly file if you have a Schedule C income, which is
it's a loss.
Or even with a loss, you should file that because there's going to be probably a 1099 miscellaneous issued for the income you had with it, and your expenses or something else is causing that to be a loss. But that should be filed to be reconciled. Mm-hmm. The IRS will compare the documents they receive with the documents that you include on your tax return, and if they don't match, then there'll be a letter coming for you to explain that difference.
Oh, what are you talking about, 1099, comparing two different things?
A 1099 miscellaneous form is a non-employee compensation form. If you're strictly a self-employed individual, that may be different. But if you are an independent contractor working for someone else, that would be issued. And it's like a W-2 form.
Okay, well, the thing is, I haven't contracted, but I do stuff that I do report that a lot of people do under the table. But I report it, and I tell other people who are in the same business to report it, too, because they'll realize how much money they're not making.
Well, I can tell you that Schedule M that you mentioned, that would be the making, that has expired, so you won't be seeing that for when you come to file this coming tax filing season.
Okay,
so
Tom.
That factors out.
Hope that helps. Thanks for the call, Tom. Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Hey, I had a question. I was curious about something, kind of settle an argument that I had with some friends. I was wondering about charitable giving and anonymity. Like, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I may give them $400 or $500 in a year's time, but I have no paper trail. I also do this with the YMCA. It may be, you know, could be anything. My church, where I'll give in anonymity, and I don't want them to know where the money came from.
Hmm. Well, that's a toughie.
That is a
because
toughie.
It's fine if you don't itemize. If you just take the standard deduction, then that's fine. But I can tell you that if it were to come to an audit, they would be asking for some sort of documentation.
The tax law says anything over $200, you should have a receipt from your organization. Now, if you want to remain anonymous, that's on the edge of the tax law. Certainly a check or something like that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. But the tax code currently says anything over $200, you need a receipt from the organization.
So I'm okay up to $200. I can say that I gave, let's say, AA $200 this year, and I can use it?
You should have a receipt, a check stub, something like that, or a canceled check.
Usually it's a basket that goes around and throw $5 in it, you know, and that adds up after 365 meetings.
Sure does.
Right. It does add up. What I generally recommend is that try to get a receipt for any amount, again, even if it's $5. Because if it were to come to an audit and someone were to ask you for the documentation, that would just be a nice sort of thing to have to show that, yes, indeed, I did make this contribution. Is it possible for you to make a donation and just say, I don't know, in some cases, if, for example, you donate to one of the music organizations here in town, and in the programs it says by anonymous, it doesn't necessarily have to list the name of the donor.
It doesn't go public with it.
Yeah, it's not a public thing, but is it still perhaps possible for you to get some sort of receipt or of some sort? Or
I'm sure it is with certain things, but I don't think with AA. But have you ever gone face-to-face and challenged the IRS about something of that nature and just say, hey, look, I know I gave it to them. I have no receipt. But
well, Jenny is the IRS.
And, well, what I recommend, and this is from what I hear in other folks being audited throughout the day, they will ask for a copy of a receipt or some sort of written documentation of a donation, even if it's a smaller amount. So, all I can tell you is what I'm recommending is that if you make a donation, try to get some sort of written documentation for it in the event that you should get audited down the road, unless, of course, you don't plan to itemize. If you don't care about itemizing and you just take the standard deduction, then it really is, you know, it's a wash. It doesn't really matter one way or the other.
Dan, thanks for that call. Our guests, Bruce Gelsinger from the AARP, he's a regional tax aid leader there, and also Jennifer Jenkins of the IRS in Ohio. We'll continue the conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
David Coleman Hadley was one of the leaders of the terrorist attack on Mumbai. The son of a Pakistani father and American mother, Hadley became a drug smuggler, then a DEA informant, and after 9/11, an Islamic militant while working for the DEA. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with investigative reporter Sebastian Rotella about his new Frontline documentary. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Beginning with Woody Allen's childhood and his first professional gigs as a teen, American Masters Woody Allen, a documentary, chronicles the trajectory and longevity of Allen's career. From his work in the 1950s and 60s as a TV scribe for Sid Caesar, to a writer-director averaging one film per year for more than 40 years, this show covers Allen's earliest film work through this year's box office smash, Midnight in Paris. Watch Woody Allen, a documentary, tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, celebrating the season with Home for the Holidays. Vocalist Helen Welch joins the CJO in this annual tradition of holiday favorites, November 30th through December 4th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
A chance of rain today and a high of 52 degrees. Expect some rain tonight, a low of 46. And then rain and maybe a thunderstorm tomorrow, a high of 64. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're having an end-of-the-year discussion about how to get ready for the preparing your tax returns for 2011. They'll be due on April 17th, not April 15th this year, but be that as it may, this is a good time to start thinking about it. Coming up later, we're going to talk about some numbers for you that you can call where you can get some volunteer help to help you file your tax returns. Sometimes it helps to have somebody else looking them over with you. We've got some calls, and I've got an email from Paul, and I wanted to get to all that. But first, you're recruiting, you're looking for volunteers to help people, Jenny, you said. Can you tell us about what you're doing and also Bruce, you?
Well, the IRS partners with various agencies to try to find volunteers to help others, low-income, seniors, disabled in their local communities to prepare their federal tax returns for free. We do this through our VITA program, Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, and also TCE, Tax Counseling for the Elderly program, which ARP is a big, big partner in that. And right now we're heavily in recruiting mode. We need to get volunteers trained on 2011 tax information so they can go out and help others.
Can anyone volunteer?
Just about anyone can volunteer.
Anyone who has a desire to help others, yes. Mm-hmm. We will do the training.
And it doesn't require a significant tax background, and there are a number of positions that someone could actually fill. Not everyone has to actually prepare returns. They can be greeters. They can be sort of like tech folks who just try to help out, make sure everything's online and so forth.
Within the AARP Tax Aid Program, we have probably 1,500 volunteers here in the state of Ohio currently preparing taxes. We e-file about 95% of the returns, so we have a big need for the techies, for example, and they don't have to be tax preparers if they want to volunteer to help set up computers, maybe help set up networks, that sort of thing.
Where should people go to find out more about it if they want to volunteer?
If they want to volunteer, there's an 800 number I can give you for AARP. It's 888-687-2277. There's also various, you could contact the local AARP office, and there's various other ways to.
Can you repeat that number?
Sure, 888-687-2277.
Okay.
If you have access to the internet, you can go to aarp.org to volunteer with them. And there's other volunteer organizations that Jenny just mentioned as well.
Mm-hmm. For the VITA program, for example, go to our IRS website, irs.gov, and type in tax volunteer in the search box, or if someone's interested and to have some information emailed to them, they can send an email to taxvolunteer@irs.gov, taxvolunteer@irs.gov, and then someone will be getting in contact with that individual and send them information on the program.
Many VITA sites are open evenings and weekends. Many AARP sites are open 8 to 5 during the week type of thing. So we have two very different times, but very similar programs and volunteer efforts.
Okay. Last year here in the Columbus area, I think there were about 110 or so VITA volunteers. And those folks, they helped prepare not quite 4,000 returns. So it's a significant contribution.
And could you use more?
Columbus,
I mean, is there always more where that came from?
Sure. Okay. We can use more throughout. That was just Columbus. We could use throughout Delaware County, Union, and throughout the state. And
in the state of Ohio, AARP tax preparers last year prepared about 73,000 returns.
Wow.
This is a huge organization.
Mm-hmm. Russ in Columbus, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Russ. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My problem, I guess it's not that uncommon, but it's got me baffled. I lost my job in 2004. My factory closed down, and I've been kind of self-employed ever since. Nothing official. I just make some money on the side. And I filed taxes until 5 or 6 years ago, and then I just kind of stopped. I don't think I've made more than about $10,000 or $15,000 in any year until this year. This year I made $120,000. Now I don't know what to do. I, you know, as far as receipts go, that's a laugh. Like I said, for most of those years it was an absolute minimal amount, but I've not filed any taxes. And I don't know where to start, and I don't know what to do.
My suggestion would be to contact a tax preparer, whether it's a volunteer preparer or a paid preparer. We should be filing taxes. There may be an earned income credit if you have some earned income, and that would mean you might even get credit back. Certainly this year you'd need to file, but most of our sites on the VITA sites as well are set up with prior year tax software there, so they could file generally 3 years plus the current year.
Okay. So get some help, Russ. Number one piece of advice. Jenny, do you want to add anything to that? That's good.
No, that's...
All right. Good luck, Russ. Joe in Columbus, yep. You're on the air. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Yes, ma'am. My wife is in a rest home, and it costs about $6,000 a month, and I'm reimbursed through long-term care insurance. How does that work as far as taxes is concerned?
Well, if it's an expense that you're receiving some reimbursement for, then you can't claim the expense to the amount that you're getting reimbursed for it.
Right. It'd be any cost that would be out of pocket would be deductible on Schedule A in general terms. Now, some of those policies are written, so there's a daily compensation. Some of them are written other ways. So my suggestion would be consult a preparer and look into that. But generally, your out-of-pocket medical costs for something like this, as well as the other things we mentioned earlier, would be deductible on Schedule A.
Okay, but do I need to claim the $6,000 a month that the insurance company pays me as income?
No, that is not income. That's a reimbursement of a medical expense.
Okay, then Okay. Basically it's a wash.
If you're not paying anything outside of $6,000 a month.
Oh, I pay more than that. It costs me a little more than that.
Well, the excess is what would be deductible.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay. I was more wondering about the claiming one as the income and the other as expense, and it would be a wash or something, but it don't even need to be mentioned.
It doesn't. This is not something that you're receiving a W-2 or 1099 on, or so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hope that helped, Joe.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I wanted to hear it.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care. My guests, Jennifer Jenkins of the IRS in Ohio, and also Bruce Gelsinger of the AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader. Questions for them? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. From Paul, he emails us, this question is to keep my tax cabinet from becoming Fibber McGee's closet. I understand some records and returns must be kept 3 years, some 7 years, and some like capital improvements to homes for calculating gains on the sale of the home must be kept indefinitely. What are the rules and which publications cover these retention periods? Good question, Paul. Jenny?
It sounds to me like he's got a pretty good grasp of the regulation as it is. For those things that are long-term capital, like home, when you're trying to figure out if you might owe some money on the sale of your home down the road, you want to keep that information on how much you paid into it when you first bought it and so on, and any improvements that you've made to adjust the basis, I guess, and then stocks that you may have had for a long time.
Especially reinvested dividends in stocks, that's a key issue.
Right. I guess he's looking for a specific publication that he would be able to refer to.
There is a records
retention.
There is a
records retention pub, and I don't remember the number of it offhand. One of the things that on home ownership, for example, years ago, everything had to be kept track of. Now there is a $250,000 exclusion on the sale of your home if you meet certain conditions, and most people do, that is excluded from gains. So even if you had a gain on the sale of your home, there's a $250,000 exclusion.
I believe somewhere in publication 17, which is what I'm kind of leafing through right now, I think there's something in there that says how long to keep your paperwork. So I'm looking for that right now.
Paul, we'll try to nail that one for you for the end, but you seem to be better off than most people, Paul. Fibber-McGee, not at all.
Yeah, actually, I did find that. Oh, yeah. It is publication 17, and it's probably elsewhere as well. And I'm looking at the 2010 edition, but on page 16, chapter 1, there's a section that says specifically what records should I keep, and that just kind of there's a paragraph and a half that talks about, I'm sorry, a column and a half that talks about exactly that question.
And someone can go online to find that publication as well, right?
Correct.
Yes.
All that stuff's online. So hope that helps. Nick from Newark, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Hi. I've got a question. I don't want to harp on donations, but it's a donation made to Goodwill of a piece of it was an imported piece of medical equipment that was rather expensive when it was new. It was about $6,000, and it's about 10 years old. But I was looking into some of the paperwork about when you needed to get an appraisal on a donated item, and I was a little bit unclear about when you needed an appraisal on something or how I'd go about making a record of that donation.
I believe it's a 250. If it's worth, is it 250 or 500 more? $500 or more? Yeah, then maybe I'll let you go ahead,
Bruce,
and take this one.
Take it away, Bruce.
Yeah, when you have a large donation like that, of course, it must be in good and usable condition, and then you have to determine what the fair market value is, and that's not always the easiest. Having an appraisal done is a good way to do that, and it documents then what the value is. Just claiming that it's worth several thousand dollars in return really doesn't cut it.
Okay. Like I said, it was imported from Italy. And actually, no one within the United States anymore even sells this brand of rehab equipment. So I emailed the company in Italy, and they gave me – the owner sent me an email back about what it would be worth currently if he were to resell it in Italy. He gave me the value in U.S. dollars. Mm-hmm. Now, would that be sufficient enough to document fair market value?
It sounds like you have gone down the road to define what that fair market value is. And a lot of taxpayers may not go to that extent. So it sounds like you're proceeding in the right direction.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Take care, Nick. If you want to email us, we have just a few minutes left, so get the emails in right away. Otherwise, you can call us. We have a few minutes, 614-292-8513. Emails at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Marie. She says, my 24-year-old son has lived with me all year, and I've provided over half his support. I've heard that I can no longer claim him as a dependent because he graduated from college last year and earned more than $3,700 this year. Is this correct?
Yes, it is correct.
Okay. Marie?
A student under the age of 24 still qualifies as a dependent without regard to how much income they earn. But once they graduate, then there's that income trigger. Okay.
All right, Marie, you're well informed. Email from Lily. She says, could I deduct my medical expenses if I paid for them using the money in my health savings account? I've always assumed I couldn't because HSAs are funded with pre-tax dollars, so I've already received a tax break.
There's a separate form for HSAs that can be included in your tax return to determine what is deductible, what is taxable.
Okay. Email from Karen. Just listening about your tax volunteers, I was wondering what the liability of the volunteer would be in helping someone else prepare their return.
There is a Volunteer Protection Act where if you are working within your training and within scope as defined by the program, that Volunteer Protection Act would protect you unless there's an obvious mistake that's intentional. If you knowingly prepare a false return, of course, that would fall outside the Volunteer Protection Act.
And the main thing to keep in mind is that these volunteer tax preparers are not doing the complicated returns. They're not doing business returns, as far as I know, within both the sides, VITA and TCE-ARP. But, you know, if you go through the training and you do the return preparation as a volunteer, you'll pick up some good ideas that you might be able to, you know, use yourself and maybe find out about.
And our sites are not staffed with one individual. They're staffed with various individuals, some with more experience than others. Mm-hmm. There's always people to turn to there to help if there's something that comes up. But like I say, if you – and yes, our scope is limited. We do not do things like businesses. We don't do rentals. We don't do farm returns. But the wages, the various income streams, we do Schedule C, we will do for the self-employed individual. You work within scope and within your competency on a training, there is not a problem.
Gail in Columbus writes, if all my medical expenses are paid for from a health insurance savings, can you still itemize expenses or get any deductions?
Well, it's similar to the question on the health savings account.
That's what I
want. And there is
a
separate form in the tax documentation, a separate form that has to be filled on health savings, showing how much you've contributed to it and what you've drawn from it and what you've used it for.
Well, we have gone over just about everything we can, but choosing a tax preparer, that makes a lot of people nervous. Now, of course, they can avail themselves if they qualify for the volunteer operations, but what should somebody look for? What do you advise people to do when they're looking for a tax preparer? Not some fly-by-night joint that pops up and says they'll get you $500 for $50, but beyond that, Jenny?
I would say that it's important to go with a reputable, established firm or someone who belongs to some sort of professional society that they have to go through training at least on a yearly basis. Check the credentials, check with neighbors, friends, check with the Better Business Bureau to see if there are any complaints against the particular individual tax preparer or firm, if you will. Also, try to avoid those tax preparers who sort of claim, big returns without having taken a look at all of your financial records beforehand. Also, a big thing is with the IRS Return Preparer Initiative, paid return preparers, for the most part, are required now to be registered with the IRS and have something called a PTIN, Prepare Tax Identification Number. And taxpayers should never sign a blank return. They should never go with somebody who's not providing them with a PTIN or something to that effect. And also just to, keep in mind that, again, this is their personal financial information and not just to, hand it out very loosely.
I would like to mention that for low-income taxpayers, we are having a Super Saturday, the first Saturday in February, where low-income taxpayers can come to the Columbus Downtown High School, and it will be a combination of volunteers from the EITC Coalition, VITA, and AARP assisting the low-income taxpayers there.
Okay, so with the IRS, if you want to get that form, 1-800-829-3676. If you want to volunteer, go to taxvolunteers@irs.gov. And for the state of Ohio, if you need some help, 888-687-2277 is the number. You can also go to aarp.org. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. And thanks to Bruce and Jennifer. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.